Okay, we're going to get started then. Welcome everyone to this important session that's taking part of Marxism 2019. Before we begin, I just wanted to acknowledge that this meeting is taking place on stolen Aboriginal land, and that especially in the context of a discussion about the dispossession of the Indigenous people of Palestine, it's important that we acknowledge the Indigenous people of this land and to say that this land was not ceded willingly. It was a battle that Indigenous people fought against white invasion, and that in the socialist tradition, the people who are hosting this conference, we stand firmly and unambiguously on the side of those who are fighting back amongst the Indigenous population. We have three speakers today. We have on my left Jamil, who will be, he's a Melbourne Palestinian, and he's been involved in the campaign here for a long time. He's going to be giving a bit of history and context to what is happening currently in Palestine. We'll be then hearing from Remy Kanzai, who's currently stuck in New York. It's a problem that many of us would probably like to have. But anyway, he is the author of this book. He's a spoken word poet. He was meant to come to this conference to participate in it, but was stymied on a series of different fronts. It's worthwhile knowing, initially he applied for the electronic visa as part of entry into Australia, which all of the other guests that have been come from the United States to participate in Marxism 2019 got without problem. Even Justin Akers-Chacon, who is a Latino activist campaigning against the border wall between Mexico and the United States, was granted that visa automatically. When Remy applied, they said that his name had flags on it, and apparently many Middle Eastern people or people of Middle Eastern descent in the United States, especially Palestinian activists, are automatically refused the automatic electronic visa. So, you know, that was the first stage of the process that we went down. Then he applied for a couple of other visas and was rejected from those and was in the process of applying and having a third visa processed, after which, you know, he ran out of time, or the department ran out of time. So we are hoping and that he will be given a visa. We're going to fight for it. And we're hoping that he will be able to come to Australia in August for the socialism that are happening. Regardless, we think it's very important that the Marxism conference hear Remy's voice, that we want this meeting today to not only be a meeting of discussion and debate, but also a meeting of resistance. And to the extent that we can actually defy the Australian government's attempt to suppress Palestinian voices, we want to do that over this conference. And so hearing Remy today is part of that project. The third speaker that we have today is Reem. She is also a long-term Palestinian activist. She's a Palestinian whose parents were forced to flee Palestine in 1948 and then again in 1967. And so she will be speaking about the resistance to Israeli apartheid, Israeli occupation. And so that will be the panel, and then we'll have some time for discussion and commentary after that. I should have said, my name is Vashti Kenway. I'm one of the organisers of the Marxism Conference, and I've also been involved in the Palestine campaign here in Melbourne since 2010. So I will hand it over, first of all, to Jamil. Please make him feel welcome.
I'll be focusing on the recent Israeli elections and development in Israeli politics today to set the scene for the solidarity movement and the struggle against the apartheid. So in a recent election ad, the far-right New Right Party and the Justice Minister at the time, Eilert Shakad, sprays herself with perfume labelled fascism. Mm. Then comes the punchline. To me, it smells like Palestinian-Israeli officials at polling stations across several Palestinian towns said cameras were attached to Likud representatives within the polling stations with cameras visible facing Palestinians voting, an act of intimidation. So the 2019 Israeli elections continued a worrisome trend that saw Netanyahu win his fifth term. The trend is a continuation of the most right-wing coalition in Israeli history, but then a coalition that is becoming more right-wing and has more of an Israeli population that, behind it as well. But this first term is different, situates itself in a different world to one of past Netanyahu governments. This time has been egged on by a growing right-wing international movement led by Donald Trump, recently joined by the elected fascist Bolsonaro in Brazil, and far-right parties growing in Europe, and even his neighbour, brutal dictator in Egypt, al-Sisi. So in this context, Netanyahu just scraped over the line, haunted by corruption scandals. But he scraped over the line thanks to another bloody episode of bombing in Gaza just last month, help with his old mate Donald Trump, and concessions to an alt-right bloc within Israeli Knesset now, who will likely hold balance of power when Netanyahu forms a coalition. The elections are over, but they're yet to finalise the official coalition. So the backdrop of this was, for years now, we've seen this growing tension within Israeli politics on the strategy of the colonial project. I mean, many of us that have been following the politics of the area for a while now will be familiar with what's happening on the ground and has been for a long time. We've seen persistent and gradual colonial expansion of settlements, particularly at the moment focused around East Jerusalem, where there's been sort of ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, replacing this with settlements, but along with the rest of the West Bank as well as fierce repression directed at Palestinian civil society. But coupled with that, there's been a growing impatience within the far right in Israel society with the so-called peace process, the two-state solution, which is complete nonsense, and the democratic charade. So within that, the Netanyahu government has been committed to the tried and tested peace process, or at least just talking about talks about the peace process with the Palestinian Authority. And then this has worked all right for him because in press conferences, talk of peace and democracy is well liked by liberals such as Obama and the Labour Party here in Australia. They're happy in this context to be cheerleaders of apartheid Israel. So the politics of the Israeli far right, now more mainstream in Israeli politics, has an advocate in the White House. So the ideological pillars of the peace process facade that has given shelter to the colonial project on the ground in Palestine are looking more expendable. I want to say a couple more things on the Israeli elections before talking about Trump's direct intervention into the election itself. So Netanyahu's election opponent was seen to be a bit more moderate, Benny Gantz from the new Blue and White Party, a new formation. But in reality, this military general, who actually led the bloody massacre in Gaza in 2014, in substance shares the same policies as Netanyahu. But still, after the election, his response, I think, was telling with the perception of what Netanyahu represents. He said, the Netanyahu government will distance Israel from law and democracy. He looks like the kind of guy that Trump could get behind. Also, part of the elections is, I think, it's worth looking at the coalition that will likely be formed around Netanyahu. His natural allies are the ultra-religious and ultra-far-right. Israel Lieberman, who was the former defence minister, looks like his party will hold the balance of power within the coalition. He's been the coalition in the past, and many commentators have referred to him as a fascist. He's known for advocating for ethnic cleansing of Palestinian Israelis, and for being quite staunch in his determination that Israel should destroy Hamas. What he means by that is not specified, but clearly he's for an escalation, another one that exceeds all before it in Gaza. In November last year, he angrily left the cabinet as defense minister because during an escalation in Gaza, Netanyahu did not go further enough. He says that Netanyahu needed to have escalated to a point of destroying Hamas. So in this context, he left the government. Netanyahu will have to keep this guy happy to form a coalition. So what concessions this means is still unknown. This is a backdrop, but Trump's blatantly waged a foreign intervention into Israeli politics. Not like the fake news intervention of Russia into the last US elections, but the real deal intervention. I'm going to give you a few examples. So last year, Trump backed a US embassy move to Jerusalem to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. In effect, that's recognizing what's already been on the ground, which has been a continual and relentless colonization and takeover of Jerusalem itself. Netanyahu can claim victory for this move. Very recently, during the election campaign, Trump authorized the annexation of the Golan Heights. This is a land that was Syrian's, but Israel illegally occupied it in the 1967 war. This authorization was a publicity stunt, really. So Israel's took over it in 1967 and then legally annexed it under its own colonial law in 1981. So this, again, was just a way of for Netanyahu to claim another victory. Trump also classified the Iranian Revolutionary Guard very recently as a terrorist organization. Again, Netanyahu took credit for this. Probably the most significant development in the election campaign was Netanyahu flagging that in a local interview that he would support sovereignty over all Israeli settlements in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem. Naturally, this came with tacit US authorization, with Mike Pompeo, the US Secretary, in an interview saying that he would support annexation, so going one step further than Netanyahu himself. And this would really mark, or many commentators say this really mark the absolute end of the era of peace negotiations shaping the dialogue out of the Palestinian-Israeli so-called conflict. In reality, annexation of the West Bank has been going on for 50 years. Colonial settlements are part of Israeli society in all but law. If you're a Jewish Israeli in Tel Aviv, you could drive to settlements within East Jerusalem or the West Bank on Jewish-only roads seamlessly, far easier than Palestinians could travel town to town where they have got checkpoints and apartheid walls blocking their way. But annexation and sovereignty of settlements in East Jerusalem and West Bank would be wracked in international controversy. It would be harder for Western politicians to justify using the language of democracy, civility, and peace talks to support Israel. But, that said, there's no doubt that Western mainstream politicians wouldn't steal back the colonial project. But nonetheless, there would be some protests. Bill Shorten, you wouldn't trust him at all. So, there's no doubt the Labour Party still would have unquestioning support. But there's other reasons why Netanyahu would be slightly hesitant to do it. But first, what would it mean for an official annexation or sovereignty over the settlements in West Bank? Well, Israel would likely take use this opportunity to take all that's valuable in the West Bank and leave even smaller enclaves for Palestinians to live with. More Palestinians would be dispossessed from their homes. There would likely be complete takeover off East Jerusalem itself. And so more Palestinians would be separated from farmers, surrounded by more walls and checkpoints. So there's a history of Israel using like conflicts and taking more land in 1967, 48. Every time Israel has just used any excuse it can have to take more land, you could imagine this being them using this situation in the same way. But a couple of reasons why Netanyahu would have some hesitation. One, interestingly, in response to Netanyahu's support for taking sovereignty over the settlements, 9 large mainstream US Jewish groups, both liberal and conservative Zionist organizations, wrote to Trump asking him to preserve the two-state solution in the face of the Netanyahu pledge. So the Times of Israel, a hard Zionist paper within Israel, stated that the letter is unprecedented in the sense that mainstream Jewish organizations within U.S. never plead to the U.S. government to try to restrain an Israeli PM. Normally it's the complete opposite. And this letter explains why they're against it. It's not because they're against annexation or colonization. It's because they're worried about what this would do to the support of Democratic voters for the Jewish population within US, which there is growing anti-Zionist voices within these communities, and they're worried that it'll be harder to justify the Zionist colonial project if this goes ahead. Also, at the moment, we're seeing revolutions in Sudan, Algeria, and there's an ongoing struggle of Palestinians themselves, but this could spark more opposition. So there's another way Trump has intervened is in a way that Palestinians are directly feeling the pinch by. He's cut over $500 million of U.S. aid to a U.S. aid organization and the United Nations Refugee Organization. Seemed to put pressure on the Palestinian Authority, undermine Palestinians' claims as refugee status, and just tighten the screws even more on Palestinians. So tens of thousands have lost access to food stamps, support infrastructure projects in Gaza and West Bank have been put on hold. Whether these funds are eventually replaced is unknown from elsewhere, but right now it has amplified the grind of the occupation. In multiple ways, Trump's made his intervention into the Israeli and Palestinian society felt. A month ago, with Netanyahu in the election mode, he ordered Israeli bombs to light the peaceful Gazan night sky on fire. He killed 4 Palestinians, bombed down many more homes. This did not stop a continuation of the Great March for Return movement. On the 1-year anniversary, just recently, 40,000 Palestinians marched quite courageously in Gaza. Palestinians have demonstrated stubborn tenacity to resist regardless of the repression they face. So whatever turn Israeli politics takes, we need to remind ourselves that Trump, Netanyahu, and the Abbotts and Duttons of Australia see their fight as an international one. They are on the offensive internationally, and we must see our fight as international too. Our politics must be one of solidarity with the Palestinians and their resistance, but also opposition to a growing far right in Australia, as seeing this as being part of the same fight. On that, I'll flag that there will be a Nakba rally around mid-May in Melbourne and probably around Australia as well. So we should participate in that and the anti-fascist movement here in Australia.
Okay, so we're going to hear from Remy now. So pending technological success. Can you chat amongst yourselves briefly? Okay, we're just going to need 1 or 2 brief minutes. That's okay. Just don't look. Just turn to each other, chat, do something else. There aren't curtains over those windows. No, they're just... Oh, are there? There are. Yeah. Maybe the tech people can turn down the other light.
Oh, okay, good.
Can everyone see that okay? Yeah.
Okay. I do. I'm pulling them up right now. Okay, perfect. Yes. Can I go anytime? Oh, cool. I want to say again, I know I sent a message into the conference, but I just want to say that I'm sorry that I couldn't be there. I really want to thank the organizers for having me out or trying to get me out there, jumping through obstacles and hoops. And I do want to say that I plan on going to Australia, to Melbourne, to Sydney, to Perth, to other stops, making it bigger and better next time around. But I'm going to do a self Q&A. I think I'm going to ask myself a few questions, and then I'm going to answer them. And then I got WhatsApp open, so if there's more questions, I can answer those. It is 1 a.m. my time. I just had 3 cups of coffee, so it is wonderful to be staring into my screen at you. The first question is, say something about yourself and your history. So my name is Jeremy Kanazi. I'm a Palestinian-American poet. I grew up in a small town in Massachusetts in the United States. I'm the son and grandson of Palestinian refugees. You know, I grew up in this kind of small town, 9,000 people, predominantly white. We were the only Arab family. But my grandmother was pregnant with my mom when they were kicked out of Palestine. And so I moved to New York City 4 months before 9/11. And when those two towers came down, there was so much vitriolic language. There was all that talk about we got to go into the Middle East into a parking lot, we got to nuke them and start over. And so for me, I was just getting into leftist politics, just read like my first book by Noam Chomsky. And so I started reading everything I could from prison abolitionists like Angela Davis to Palestinian intellectuals like Edward Said. And then in 2004, my brother and sister took me to go see Def Poetry Jam on Broadway. It was the first time I saw Suher Hamed, who was a Palestinian poet, perform live, and so many other folks from different communities that were infusing art and culture and their lived experiences, and I literally went home that night and wrote a terrible poem. As time kind of went on, and I was organizing and performing at rallies, then the bombing on Lebanon and Gaza happened in 2006, then massacre on Gaza in 2008, 2009, and you started to see this kind of manifestation of Palestine organizing in the U.S. in a way that I hadn't in the previous 7 or 8 years. And so that kind of brings me up to 2019 and why I was supposed to be at the Marxism conference, I believe, to talk about challenging walls from the U.S.-Mexico border to Australia to Palestine. I was going to perform for you all and also talk on this panel about the intersection of art and resistance, which I don't think I'm going to do now because I'm only going to speak to you for another 6 minutes. So I'm going to look at my paper, and I think I'm going to ask myself another question. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So what is your sense of international solidarity, and what can be done internationally? So I would say that in the United States, 5 or 10 years ago, you could barely say the word Palestine at a local community event or on a campus without being protested or smeared. But back in the day, you were essentially ignored. Then they kind of moved on to attacking you. Now there's anti-BDS laws and blacklists and the U.S. government that's taking action. But when I first started performing, there was probably 5 Students for Justice in Palestine chapters on college campuses. Today, in the U.S. and Canada, there's more than 200. If if you look at the trajectory of Black Palestinian solidarity, Native Palestinian solidarity, queer Palestinian solidarity, there's more folks speaking up on Palestine than ever before. And it's important. I know that you all have like a right-wing racist third-term government in Australia, and we are the big empire and the settler colonial state in the United States, but we're kind of the last domino to fall. Like, first it's going to be Chile and South Africa, and then your Norway's and Switzerland's, and then finally your Canada's, UK's, Australia's, and then the US. It was Reagan who vetoed sanctions in the 1980s against South African apartheid. So if you look at people power, if you look at communities coming together, yes, there's attacks on people like Marco Montehill, who lost his job on CNN, and Angela Davis, who was attacked when she was going to win an award or be presented with an award in Birmingham, and the attacks on Michelle Alexander, the brilliant author of The New Jim Crow, who wrote a great piece in The New York Times, or the death threats that Ilhan Omar is facing that are steeped in anti-Black racism and Islamophobia and misogyny and anti-Palestinian racism. But if you look at the masses folks who are speaking up, whether it's Black and brown folks, whether it's anti-war folks, whether it's Marxists, people aren't stopping. They're not shutting up. They're not staying silent. They're moving forward on culture boycott and BDS and divestment campaigns on campus. There's more coalition building than ever before. And Palestine, in a way, because I'll speak to the U.S. context, has been more inserted as a progressive issue than ever before. I remember going to rallies 10 years ago, anti-war rallies, and people would be waving Palestinian flags, and the organizer would say, hey, this is an anti-war rally, don't wave a Palestinian flag, as if anti-apartheid shouldn't be intermixed with the idea of anti-war. So things have really shifted, the conversation has shifted, solidarity that is, you know, built on a larger history of generations and generations, but I would say within the last 15 years, operating in the United States, organizing, I've never seen so much principled love for Palestine, and the complexity of organizing among the average 19-year-old today is so much further along than it was 5 years ago. And there's been this feeling that we've been at stage one for so long that now we might be at stage three of 25, but it almost feels like a great thing given where we were for such a long time. And I speak to this while also reminding folks, in which the first speaker did, that in some ways things have never been worse in Palestine. So there's been a rise of international solidarity in a really beautiful way, and then you're dealing with the reality that Israel controls the air, the border, the sea, the imports, the taxes, the tariffs, the population registry, execution of Palestinians in Gaza, 2 million people trapped in an open-air prison, 97% of the water not fit for drinking, not livable by 2020, while millions of people are saying it's not livable now. But what I think that in Australia or the United States we should carry with us is the idea that we're all small puzzle pieces in a much larger frame, and those small steps do create a big wave. So thank you to the organizers, thank you to the participants that are at the conference, that your core issue might not be Palestine organizing. You're Marxist, I assume, but you could be working on indigenous issues, you could be working on feminist causes, you could be working against transphobia or exploitation of workers at your local university or Palestine. We need all of us, and there's a heck of a lot of issues to fight on that go beyond Palestine, but it's operating with that idea that nobody should live under a system of oppression, nobody should live under a system of apartheid, nobody should see their families ethnically cleansed. So, yeah, I really wanted to be there with you all to connect, to collaborate, to break bread, to brainstorm, to organize, and hopefully I can do it with you all soon.
Okay, all right. Okay, I'll hand it over to Reem.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to speak to you about the Palestinian resistance from now and also from a historical context. I just have one quote to read for you. It was a quote by Edward Said, he's a Palestinian author, the late Edward Said. He was against Oslo. So he says that if you want to get the facts, of course the facts will hold interpretations, and these interpretations will depend on who the interpreter is, who is he or she addressing, and what is the purpose, and what is the historical movement that the interpretation takes place. And in that context, I will be talking about the Palestinian resistance. Of course, as a Marxist, we are all assuming, I'm assuming here are leftists, I will make a class analysis for the nature of the Palestinian resistance. Historically, the Palestinian resistance, even before 1948, it went through two phases of confrontation or resistance. The first one is when they were under the British mandate, and it culminated in 1936 to 1939 massive Palestinian uprising, which was brutally crushed by the British. I won't stop at that. I'm just mentioning it to tell you that the most important bit that I want to speak about is actually the resistance after 1948. Now, to understand the Palestinian factions that carried out the resistance since 1948, we have to remember that the Palestinian society was multi-layered. We can't escape class. There were at least 10%, 10 to 15% landowners. It was a largely agrarian society. They left during the expulsion of 1948, basically mostly unscathed. Yes, they lost their land. Israel will not compensate them for the lands that they lost. But they carried with them a lot of transferable assets, and they could live nicely in the host Arabic countries that they were gone to, so they didn't have to live in the camps. The other layer is the second largest, but it's still small, another 5%, which is the petty bourgeoisie or the professionals. They did feel the brunt of the repulsion, expulsion of 1948. They lived in the beginning in the camps, but then, again, because of their education and their skills, they could be employed, they could work outside in the Gulf states or even in Saudi Arabia in the oil industry for a very brief time, and in other Arab countries. So they could become even wealthier and wealthier and become even the new bourgeoisie. So to sum it up, 15% of the Palestinians of the diaspora were actually, I'm talking about the period of the 50s, they were actually the most advanced section of Arab capitalism at the time, in every single Arab country they lived in. Now, close to 80% of the Palestinians weren't those petty bourgeoisie or the bourgeoisie. They were mostly the peasants, the poor, the ordinary unskilled workers or workers. They became the bulk of the refugee problem. And by the definition of the United Nations, a refugee, in terms of the Palestinian refugees or the UNRWA, called them as a former peasant, unskilled laborer, and former peasants and their descendants or dependents. Now, the Palestinians in the 50s were still interacting and getting influenced by the forces that be under the Arab regimes. So the Palestinian bourgeoisie, of course, as I said, they enjoyed a better life, but seldom they were given a nationality or a citizenship in the countries they lived in, especially if they were in the Gulf countries, and seldom they will be given allowed to get property. But apart from that, they were akin to the Arab ruling classes that was oppressing its own people in every country they went. On the other hand, the Palestinian poor and Yeah, they were actually more similar to the oppressed Arab working class in these countries. However, to leave the Arab Palestinian population under the thumb, the Arab countries such as Lebanon, Syria, Egypt, Iraq, Jordan, where all these Palestinians of 1948 went as refugees and lived in the camps, they maintained a very strong laws against them. The Palestinian refugees were seen as a burden and as unwanted or unwelcome guests. And in Lebanon in particular, it was very overt, the discrimination against them. They weren't allowed to go outside the camp, and no matter how skilled they are even, or educated, and get any job in the government, nor in the private sector, most of the private sector. In Syria and Iraq and Jordan, officially they were given, they were told that they are similar to the people, but actually in getting education and getting jobs, it was always a hard struggle for them. Within that context, you can see that the factions that appeared at the time, the Palestinian factions, were also influenced by these factors. So basically, I will speak at the beginning about Fatah, which is the biggest. It is spelled in all the Western literature as F-A-T-A-H, Fatah, but actually in our Palestinian dialect, we call it Fatah. And Fatah is the acronyms, is the Arabic acronyms of the movement for the national movement for the liberation of Palestine. That's the name. And the acronyms, they turn it around opposite and becomes Fatah. So Fatah was established in its early stages in the 50s by students in Cairo who were actually sons of the bourgeoisie and the petty bourgeoisie. They, in the beginning, they thought, we want to start something and make some military operations against Israel, some isolated incidents, to reach a point that pressurizes Egypt and the other Arab government to take the Palestinian issue seriously. So that was back in 1959. Arafat was one of these students. They later on based themselves in Kuwait, which was a new Gulf country at the time. Many Palestinian communities were there, like at least 400,000 Palestinians lived there, and many of them enjoyed a sort of comfortable life, and some were actually of the leaders of Fatah were actually became very affluent. When they stayed in Kuwait, they put down their principles, and that was in the early 60s. The principles of Fatah, they are very simple. They believe that the Palestinian liberation is the work of all the Palestinians, so there is no idea of class at all. Fatah is a broad church, so people can be of any other ideology and then join Fatah. They believe in the armed struggle, the revolutionary mass struggle at the time, they called it. And they wanted, of course, the liberation of the whole of historic Palestine. But their intentions stopped at that. They were actually also had another deadly contradiction within their principles, which is the principle of non-interference with the Arab regimes, the internal affairs of the Arab regimes. That was a contradiction that led Fatah and the PLO to disaster. Okay. So Fatah, as I said, was the main faction. Fatah was the leader of the PLO. But the PLO didn't spring up just like that. The PLO, Palestinian Liberation Organization, which is the umbrella group for everybody of the Palestinian factions in the diaspora, was first established, actually, by the Arab League. The Arab League of the reactionary Arab countries who have no interest in liberating Palestine. Our relationship with the Arab regimes was always a conflict of them trying to control us and us trying to break that control. So they appointed his name was Shuqairi, Ahmad Shuqairi, in 1962 Arab Summit. And that was seen actually after a few years, especially in 1967 when our enormous defeat, the Arab enormous defeat against Israel, when Israel took over, annexed the West Bank and Gaza, that enormous defeat was a big blow to the Arab regimes at the time, and they became wounded. Fatah got a lot of traction because of that, because even as early as 1962, Abdel Nasser, or known in the West as Nasser, admitted once that he doesn't have a plan for Palestine. So they actually made more their organization much more well-known in Kuwait, and they launched their first operation, and they call it the official launch, 1st of January 1965, that's to be called Fatah. 1967 happened, the defeat, only to pour in more support by the Arab masses for the Palestinians represented in the Fatah. There were other factions, which are smaller. I'll come to mention them now. But the main thing I wanted to say also, that also after that defeat, Arafat, who was youthful at the time, moved in and took over the PLO from its being the firstly when it was just a skeleton for or a stooge for the Arab League. He took over from Shuqairi. Shuqairi resigned, and Arafat took over. So he was not just the leader of Fatah, he was also the leader of the PLO, Palestinian Liberation Organization, and maintained that position until the day he died in 2004. As for the Arab leftist factions, the Palestinian leftist factions, they were also influenced by the Arab influences at the time. So in the 50s, there was a revival of the pan-Arab nationalism, and we saw the rise of Al-Ba'ath Party, which means resurrection of Arab nationalism. Michel Aflaq established it, and it became the Ba'ath of Syria and the Ba'ath of Iraq later. But there was also another better movement, which was called the ANM, Arab Nationalist Movement. This Arab Nationalist Movement continued to act, and within its ranks was a young doctor, George Habash, and his comrades, who became later the leaders of the PFLP, Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine, which actually was officially established in 11th of December 1968. Of course, there are other factions, but they were always affected by the influences of the Arab regimes. For example, the Iraqi Ba'ath Party made another faction, pro-Iraq was the Arab Liberation Front, ALF, and another one was made by Syria, pro-Syria was Sa'iqa, which means Thunderbolt. Now, these smaller factions, they didn't get any audience as much as Fatah, and PFLP was at the time the second largest. Now, I want to explain that the bourgeoisie, the Palestinian bourgeoisie, put most of their lot, all of their lot with Fatah, because they deemed Fatah as a very safe option for them. Fatah doesn't want to interfere in the internal affairs of the Arab states, so it will not disrupt their privileged lives in these Arab countries. So they put their lot there. The problem with the leftist Arab leftist or Palestinian leftist organization is basically because it looked like the Arab communist parties at the time, which was highly Stalinized. They believed in the stage theory. They believed in generalized talking to the masses. They believed in the popular front. They believed in cross-cultural alliances. They jumbled up a lot of things. Like some Arab countries, they considered them completely reactionary, whereas some of them are nationalist, which means we will vacillate. Sometimes we will be with them. Sometimes we will be against them. So actually, that did not gain them much support. Now, despite their political confusion, the PFLP and the Democratic Front, a later splinter of the PFLP, the DFLP, they pointed the two important contradictions that I talked about Fatah, which is that it is called for Palestinian unity, there is no class orientation in it, and it believes in the non-interference in the Arab regimes. They could pinpoint that. It didn't go further than that, though. Until Black September happened, that's when the Palestinians were in between 1966 to 1970, we were under the Jordan, the Palestinian factions were there. They were, the leftist factions were wanting to topple the King Hussein. It's the biggest border next to Israel. The Palestinians became like a state within a state. Their influences wasn't of being just on the border and in certain villages and towns, but they were also inside Amman, and they were actually in the camps, not allowing the government to police the camps. They were running the refugee camps. The Palestinians felt strong, and even the non-Palestinians in Jordan, and we must remember, Jordan is more than 70% of its inhabitants are Palestinians. They were all supportive of the Palestinians. Yet the hesitation of Arafat to topple the King Hussein's regime and to stay and not rock the boat gave the ailing king at the time, he wasn't the strongest king in the region, gave him the time, and he could actually, we say this saying in Arabic, so they had us for lunch before we could eat them for dinner. They came, they attacked the Arab the Palestinian camps, they attacked the thousands and thousands in Black, we call it Black September for a reason, thousands and thousands were killed by the Jordanian militias. Arafat at the time stupidly was looking for the Syrian regime and Iraqi regimes to help, or even the Egyptian. No one, everybody stood and looked passively at the time. Then Fatah and the PLO and all the factions moved to Lebanon. That was another trap. Unfortunately, the Fatah leadership did not learn from the mistake. Instead, they took the wrong lessons and they said, we have failed in Jordan because of the Salah Khalaf said it once, he's one of the leaders of Fatah, because the PFLP has jumbled up the Palestinian liberation with class struggle. And he considered that wrong. So in Lebanon, again, the disasters continued. Now, the Palestinians, after Black September, could recover and regain their confidence again, because Fatah made sure that the Palestinian capitalists, as I said, plus the Saudis, he told them that we will not rock the boat for you, just let us be your the one who fights the enemy, Israel. So actually they were helped by funds and arms from Saudi Arabia at the time as well. Then what happened is the Arab government in 1973 went into war with Israel, 1973. Straight after that war, the Arab regimes in an Arab summit gave a bait for Arafat, which is convincing Arafat, of course, through Israel and America, which is the biggest Israel backers, is to give for the Palestinians to accept to get a state in the West Bank and mini-state, they called it, a mini-state solution in the West Bank and Gaza in return to the recognition of Israel within the borders of 1948. In that time, Fatah was happy because that's what all the bourgeoisie wanted from the beginning. A capital needs a state to defend it. All right. Seems like I have to finish. So I'll have to fast forward. Obviously, they were becoming the rejectionist front sprung up. That was the led by the PFLP in the 12th session of the Palestinian National Congress. It didn't last long because they didn't want to stay marginalized. So they went back trying to think that their position within the PLO might weaken Arafat. It didn't. Arafat kept in his negotiations, and actually since 1974 when he went to the United States, Nations famously and said his speech about the gun and the olive, it was just a rhetoric. He was wearing his military uniform and he was saying, "Mr. President, I came today carrying a gun in my hand." He wasn't carrying a gun, I saw that, I was 14 years old. And he was saying, and a branch of olive, meaning that I am happy to do the negotiations and the peace process. Actually, fast forward till today, what did we have? Since 1993, since the Oslo, we had two intifadas. The first intifada, which means uprising, which started in 1987, was aborted by Arafat when he came inside Palestine, starting the Palestinian Authority. And the second intifada, which started less than 9 years with Oslo being futile, and we did get nothing from it. And again, it was aborted easily because it was militarized. And what can our simple guns do against the Israeli back to the hilt by America, Israeli army? So we had Hamas afterwards in Gaza. Hamas actually won in the Legislative Council elections in 2006. And because of that, the European Union, the Americans, the Israelis were up in arms. They wouldn't accept that. Of course, Hamas started like Fatah, saying that they wanted to liberate the whole of Palestine, the whole of historic Palestine. But actually, they followed the same path of Fatah, which is national liberation movement, class collaborationist, being established by petty bourgeoisie. So that made us now into the sorry state that we are in today, a government in the West Bank that doesn't even govern its own offices, going through checkpoints, the leaders themselves, from here to there. And in the Gaza, we have the siege since 12 years. So the siege since 12 years was basically since Hamas took over and ousted Fatah, because Fatah was about to conduct a coup against it. So actually, what we have today, which is the fantastic Great March of Return, which started exactly on 30 of March, Friday 2018. 30 of March is a day called the Land Day. It is the forgotten intifada that it was before the two intifadas. This, it is still going, and despite losing at least 250 civilians dead and maimed a lot of children and young and women, despite all that, they are still standing steadfast. If we want to understand the situation in Gaza, you have to remember, 95% of their water is undrinkable. They get only 4 hours of electricity per day. There is 45% unemployment. 46% of kids suffer acute anemia. 50% of kids express no will to live. 2 million are denied the freedom of movement. I'm talking about the 2 million who live in 360 kilometers square in Gaza. So actually, the great march of return, if you want to think about it, it's not Hamas, as what some Western reporters tell you, Hamas sending some people there to be killed so that they embarrassing Israel in the international stage. No, it is actually a collective cry for justice. It's a collective statement by the people who want to stand against the occupation, having suffered 70 years of Nakba, 50 years of military occupation, and 12 years of siege. We are still standing, and we will not back down.